Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 504. Science Faction, I call BS.
I'm going to be honest with you and the fans. I don't like I call BS. And right before you said record, and we were about to record it, we just got done recording the other episode, I thought about breaking my laptop, so I didn't have to do it. I felt like a prisoner who was let loose because of COVID, and then now that COVID's over, I'm just expected to return to prison. And last week we didn't do an I call BS, and I'm just, yep. I have a lot of anxiety, Bobby.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, what's up?
Have you ever thought about winning?
I think that is something you would not allow.
I've encouraged it, but you just seem to refuse.
Yeah, you are Donald Trump being asked to denounce white supremacists.
And speaking of Donald Trump, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
Standing down and standing by.
All right, let's just jump right in to I Call BS.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right, for those of you guys who might not know, maybe you got attracted to start listening to the show from our big 501st episode, the rules of I Call BS are quite simple and have been explained to Damian numerous times. There are four science articles, some of which are real, some of which are BS, standing for bad science. Damian tries to piece together which ones are real and which ones are fake. There's a couple of supplementary rules that are pretty standard for almost every quiz show, including no happy days
references. You so casually lie. You so casually lie, and that's what makes you evil.
Let's just get going. Let's get going because I missed it. I can't believe we haven't done I Call BS in so long. The fans desperately want it. Let's get back to the game. All right, article number one. NASA's OSIRIS-REx space shuttle touched down on an asteroid for the first time ever earlier this week, but attempts to retrieve a sample of the asteroid material for further study failed because of a decimal point misplaced in the programming of the multi-billion dollar spacecraft. Damien, is this science or bad science?
Now, you did not say how many decimal points. You're just saying a misplaced decimal.
Yes. So, like, instead of 10, 1, or 100.
This is science. It was because of a misplaced decimal. And I guess NASA's just not as autistic as it used to be.
Damien, this is actually bad science. By the way, that was incredibly offensive. This is actually bad science. I did use that because
NASA's
there have been
twice
a couple
as autistic as it ever has been. How dare you?
There's been a couple of famous instances of like things like that, like a decimal point off and all of a sudden it fucks stuff up. There was one where like one crew was working in metric and the other was working in SAE and that fucked everything up. There's a couple of issues like that. But no, in this case, they did touch down on an asteroid and the sample gathered was actually successful. Now, they are actually having some trouble closing the lid on the sampling container, but that is actually not a big problem because the container then goes into a different ship that then docks up and then that comes home, and so it'll be fine there. It was a complete and total success. And landing on an asteroid is incredibly difficult. We think of things like landing on the moon or that as very difficult, which is true. And the math on that is very, very difficult. But the math on this is another level because you are dealing with two objects moving in three-dimensional space. So we have to send the craft there in three-dimensional space. And then as this asteroid is flying in three-dimensional space, by the way, we don't send the craft to the asteroid. We have to predict where the asteroid will be at a certain point and then send the craft to that space. By the way, this is changing relative to us because the Earth is moving this whole time around the sun. So also our position relative to both of those things are changing at any given time. We then have to change the direction of that craft to match the direction of that asteroid in order to land, successfully pull a remote landing with a delay on this dynamic environment, and then pick up stuff, relaunch, and come off. It is a tremendous mathematical and engineering feat that gets overlooked for how incredibly difficult it is. This is the first time we've done this. We have crashed things into asteroids before, but this is the first time we have landed a craft that will then gather materials and come back to us.
Do you think at some point the NASA technician, as he was flying the craft in with like a remote, saw Obi-Wan who was like, use the force, shut the fuck up, no, I will use every targeting computer I can.
It is a crazy, crazy feat of math and engineering and programming and being able to design something that can basically almost autonomously, because it can't take direct action, you have too much of a delay, can almost autonomously do that landing and then can also take samples and then take back off and dock with something else, come back to Earth and just all of this stuff. It's amazing. What we are doing is freaking amazing. All right, article number two. A new study indicates that the Clovis culture was only around for about 300 years. Damien, is this science or bad science?
Bad science. Clovis aren't a real people.
They're just a shitty town in New Mexico.
I didn't even know that. So,
sorry, Damien, this one is science, and it's very interesting. So we talked about Clovis before a long, long, long time ago. We used to think that Clovis was the first group of Americans, first settlers of America. We have known that false for decades now, so I want you to always remember that, because almost every article you read will misstate this. They'll be like, up until recently, we thought they were the earliest occupation of America. No, 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 no. That hasn't been the case since the 90s. At best, you could make that argument as the 90s, and even then, we kind of knew some stuff before that. So no, that's not the case. But Clovis was around 13,000 years ago, and they have these very distinct fluted points.
I was about to say, they were known for being flautists.
Yeah, well, fluted just means they knock off these very interesting semi-conical flakes from the proximal side of the point, and then they use that to haft it onto wood. So it's very trademark. Now, there are...
That is the worst stereotype for a culture I've ever heard. That is the lamest. You can't rag on that. I can't roast that.
Hey, man, what's wrong with your regular sinew binding? Why do you need to be doing all this fluting?
God, I'm sorry. The audience just is lost. None of them have had to live a hunter-gatherer lifestyle.
So this is associated with some interesting sites, including the Ansick site in Montana, which gave us some early DNA. It's some of the early DNA that we have of the Americas that was associated with some Clovis materials, which we learned in 2017 allowed us to extrapolate that those same Clovis people expanded down into South America at some point and took over previous cultures that had lived there before from, you know, 14 to 17,000 years ago.
You call that fluting? That ain't fluting. Get out of here. It's our land.
They didn't bring their flute. That's the thing. They didn't bring those tools with them. This is a North American tool technology, but we associated it with the DNA of a burial there, and that DNA is linked to an incursion of a group around, you know, 13 to 12,000 years ago that went from North America and occupied South America, taking over a previous occupation.
It became the pan flute in South America.
That's a pretty fucking good joke.
Wow, its purpose and shape really changed in a short period of time.
So Clovis has always been interesting for a couple of reasons. They're clearly megafaunal hunters. They're hunting big game. We knew they were around for a while in the 13,000 years ago range, but we didn't know how long. There were some theories of about 1,500 years, some closer to 1,000. A few people on the fringe thought he was even longer, maybe 2,000 years or so. This new paper is actually really interesting because they did a bunch of carbon-14 dates. They did it only on known Clovis sites with directly dated Clovis materials, meaning they made sure that if they were taking something from a hearth, it was only associated with a Clovis area occupation and couldn't have been earlier or later. They did this for 11 different sites. I think they took like 40 samples, and all of them fell exactly between 13,050 and 12,750 years. By the way, they also did some really good work, because the last time we were doing some of these dates were about 2007. We were using carbon-14. We've talked about correcting carbon-14 before using dendrochronology, which basically allows you to say how much carbon-14 was in the atmosphere at any given point. The problem was, all the way back in 2007, we thought we were being pretty good by correcting using a European dendrochronology scale, and that seems a little bit off for what was going on in North America, and so this has been readjusted and redone for North American scale using North American dendrochronology, meaning that they were able to get each one of these dates down to a range of like plus or minus 50 to 100 years. You're talking 13,000 years plus or minus 50 to 100. That is crazy accurate. You are looking at a very narrow time. Like, Bill and Ted could figure out when to go back and figure out when this thing was made.
So this thing was more accurate than a phone booth?
It is, but only now because George Carlin's dead. So it loses some of the accuracy.
Yeah. There was a political realness that came with that phone booth when Carlin was running it.
Yeah, absolutely. And much like the Cars franchise, it suffered in later series because he was no longer around to voice a VW bus.
Oh, I was about to say, did they replace him with Larry the Cable Guy? Is that, hey, Bill and Ted, we gotta go, you save your, it's your chance, it's your kids. No, I'm thinking of Back to the Future.
Now, the reason this is interesting is it shows that there are other tool technologies that we thought were either derivative of Clovis or like at least kind of coinciding with it, including some stem point stuff here in the West, because Clovis is more of central southwest to the East Coast, up and through the Northern Great Plains. Not here in the West Coast, we were having Folsom points and stem points. Down south, they had fishtail points and other points. And what we found now with this really precise dating of an incredibly narrow margin is actually a lot of this stuff predates it and is basically not associated. So stuff we thought came from Clovis, turns out, no, it didn't. this predates it and was just going along parallel to it. That is really interesting. This paper is incredibly interesting, and narrowing not only each of these sites down to 50 to 100 year time span, but also Clovis itself down to only 300 years is an amazing feat of both archaeology and then, you know, obviously radiometric dating.
You know what they say about dudes who get laid? They have feats in radiometric dating and dendrochronology.
All right, article number 3. New research indicates that naked mole rats kidnap babies from neighboring colonies in raids looking for drone workers. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science. A species that's immune to acid, of course they're going to do other badass stuff like kidnap children. That's good, right? That's cool? I'm sorry, the pandemic's been going for so long, I forgot what's cool, so that's not cool?
Well, this is actually really interesting. So naked mole rats, we've talked about them a few times too. They are a very interesting animal. They're a mammal, but they live like in insect colonies, basically, where there is one breeding queen. She is the only one that's allowed to breed. All the other females have to babysit her kids. Meanwhile, all the other members of that colony, that can be many, many hundreds, are essentially sterile drone workers that just carry out work like bees almost. They have weird things where they don't quite have endothermy, like warm-bloodedness the way we think of most mammals. They're basically blind down there for the most part. They have weird immunities. They're like one of the only mammals we know of that don't seem to get cancer and stuff like that. They're just a bizarre ass animal. So researchers looking at them have never actually observed this, but what they did find was that one time when looking at a colony, they found a queen that had been fucked up, like a bunch of scratches on her face. Now, everybody in that colony respects the shit out of the queen. They're not going to fight her, so that doesn't make sense. And so they were trying to figure out what that was, and they thought maybe they're getting attacked by other colonies of naked mole rats. That mixed with some old papers that had done some genetics that had pulled out individuals from one colony that seemed to be genetically different. And they're like, how does this make sense? We know all the genetics all comes from the queen. How could this happen? And they just attributed it to an error in the lab. Like, oh shit, Bill put the wrong tags on shit again. Now we got the wrong mole rat DNA. Fuck you, Bill. In fact, what they realized in doing some follow-up research is this is what happens. One colony will raid another colony, grab pups, and bring them back. And since most of the, in fact, you'd say 99% of any given mole rat in a new colony will be a drone, just like all the other mole rats are, they are basically kidnapping child slaves to bring to their new colony and create just worker drones that then serve a new queen. So it's almost Borg-like in a way.
Yeah, and the fact that this is all coming from the top, there's just one evil queen who's like, we need more servants. My pool will be completed by summer. I am going to have a 4th of July that will blow away the underground.
Yeah, that should be a really bad supervillain, the naked mole rat, and it's just like a withered, old, hairless mole person who has 300 followers that do whatever they say.
It looks like Betty White. Listen, I think she's lovely on screen, but this is a bad look for Miss White. Oh, God.
Very, very interesting. And lastly, article number 4. The ironclad beetle has been found to have such a strong shell that it can withstand being squished in extreme circumstances, including being crushed by a car. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, maybe with your libtard Prius, but not my F-150. It couldn't even stand my titanium truck nuts.
Sorry, Damien, this one is indeed science, meaning once again you lose. You've actually got 3 out of 4 wrong.
Whoa, you're saying my F-350... ain't no match for this beetle.
Worse than a coin flip, Damien. Worse than a coin flip.
I shot the moon.
No, you didn't. You got 3 out of 4 wrong. You didn't even do that right.
All right, well, I'd like to go back and change my answer for that one I got right.
Arguably, this is the wrongest you could be.
No, because you shouldn't be even more when I get them all wrong.
Well, I'm sure you'll do that next week. Indeed, so this one is indeed science. It is a very cool animal. It's actually kind of around these parts. It's a little bit east of us. It's in the American Southwest deserts region. And it's a really cool animal that has been known to be incredibly strong for a while. But the precise engineering wasn't understood until a paper came out this week that did 2 things to look at why it was so strong. One is they 3D printed models of its shell. And you might go, well, why is that so important? And it's because there's like, even though they're bugs, there's like only so many. So there's a weird thing about just like, let's push on this till it breaks, you know, like It's a kind of moral issue. So by 3D printing this, you can try it in different forms and do this 1,000 times over.
We shit on mice left and right, but a fucking bug, which has no central nervous system, which can feel pain.
Yeah, but you don't have unlimited numbers. Like, there's mice breeding facilities, and it's easy to get a bunch of them. Like, if you had to do this for as many times you'd have to do it, I think you'd make the beetle go extinct or endangered in the endemic places it is.
Isn't that the thing? I mean, aren't insects very...
fecundant? Some, yes.
Extinction resistant?
Some, but no, not all. And certainly, like, I don't know, I think eventually it would just be some really depressed grad students pressing a hydraulic press, and they're like, crunch! All right, it was 3.15.
All right, go. I don't care. Listen, I'm as a mouse advocate, I can't even get rid of all the lice in my head. And you're telling me that there's not enough of this super Hercules beetle.
You need to stop headbutting dogs, first of all.
Dogs need to stop looking at me funny.
They also use simulations, computer simulations, and they basically were able to, by doing that, able to see, A, how it works, and there's a really cool kind of natural engineering to how this shell can interlock with itself. It's actually like different segments of shell that can interlock and absorb a bunch of impact, and that's what makes it so strong. And by using these models, both 3D models and computer simulation models, we're able to show not only why it's so strong, but the extent of its strength, and they were able to show it could withstand 39,000 times its own body weight, which the article points out would be like a person being able to have 40 M1 Abrams battle tanks on their back.
Speaking of which, can we incorporate this design into some sort of super tank?
I mean, yeah, tanks are pretty good at taking weight, though. I don't know, I don't know if there's a problem where they're like, you know what's the problem with this tank is we can't put enough stuff on top of it without it breaking.
It's not what I'm worried about. It's more the that this beetle can survive my F-350 with truck nets, with titanium truck nets. I mean, to me, that sounds like a pretty defensive design that can withstand, I guess, the equivalent to a mountain being dropped on top of a tank.
Yeah, I believe the problem in terms of if you're in a tank and you're worried about your tank taking a problem, it's more of the penetration abilities from like some uranium-tipped projectiles, yeah, that come in through. And that's less of like how much pressure can you take and more of how much piercing can you take. And I think, I'm going to put it this way. If I shot one of these beetles with a 22 round that was made out of depleted uranium, it would go through that beetle.
It would laugh at you, then hunt you to the day you died.
You know what, Damien? Let's try it. Let's go out beetle shooting with some uranium rounds.
Gotcha. Or I will play the role of the beetle and you could be the tank operator.
You know, for those of you guys who are outside of the U.S., you might not know, but you could just buy depleted uranium rounds for your pistol anywhere you want here. They're available at shooting ranges wherever you like.
That might rip your arm off if you shot like even the lowest caliber depleted uranium round.
No, it's not going to do any different in terms of mass or anything. It's just, you know, more radioactive.
they're also high velocity rounds, I believe. Like
you can shoot them much further. Sure, we can put a bigger powder charge because it's a denser material, so it doesn't break up as easily.
But wouldn't that force just come back to the human arm shooting?
Yes,
it's like the
yes.
same reason.
But you could put what I'm saying, Damien, you're being silly. What I'm saying is you put a regular depleted uranium bullet in a regular cartridge and then shoot that at a beetle like a regular person.
I remember in the army we were walking around, you could see like a tank range where they shot those where they just had a range where they shot those depleted uranium rounds, and you could just see them laying in the ground. You could just like see the spent rounds, like, oh, you're radioactive, hello cancer.
Well or just like no kids. Either one.
I'm there. I'm 40 or I'm 37 and no kids. So.
You teabagged the shit out of some uranium rounds.
Listen, I thought they'd kill Iraqis better if I did it.
I was done drawing on it with marker because it was passed out.
Yeah. My sergeant saw me, Mercado, clean the balls off the uranium rounds again. Oh, damn it, sergeant. Not again.
Thank you, audience, for coming back to Science Faction 504, where you learned all about NASA's successful landing of a craft onto an asteroid, how we've just figured out that the Clovis culture only lasted for about 300 years, why naked mole rats kidnap other mole rats' babies, and why the ironclad beetle can take 39,000 times its own body weight. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 505.
Private Mercado, do you care to explain to me why the inside of my M1 Abrams battle tank is covered in pubic hair?
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.